I'd like to do a little background first.
Yes.
Maybe you could tell me where and when you were born and how you came to Seattle.
Yes. I was born in Prince Rupert, British Columbia. And we moved to, about 3 years old, we moved to Blaine, Washington on a small farm. And then 1926, we moved to Bellingham. We went to farm. Most of our time we still field in air. And then 1930, we came to Seattle to go to the University of Washington. And, the family moved to Seattle primarily because my mother was going to the University of Washington. Then our moves from Blaine to Bellingham were probably led by our older sister who took over the family when my dad became
What did your folks do when you were growing up?
My dad, we had a small farm, and my dad was a coal miner, and we moved to Blaine because he wanted to go to medical school, and also his business gone bankrupt in Canada.
He owned himself a coal mine?
No, he owned a small grocery store. It was in the Rebel Stoke, and had a small contractor in Prince Rupert, and when they built the, and also did some important, and when they built the Panama Canal, a lot of the chickens that went through Canada and converted to the Panama Canal. But he didn't work in Blaine, he worked in it as long as he could. He could until he came into factory. He worked in the coal mines in Bellingham, Roslyn, Black Diamond, that area.
So was he farming at the same time as he was doing
it? He didn't do the farming. His children and my mother did the farming.
So you said you went to the university. Did you go through high school in Blaine? Or?
Graduated from Washington High School in Bellingham. 2 years in Blaine.
And then you went to the university?
Yeah.
Did you go all the way through the university?
16 quarters.
What was that in?
Major in political science.
Do you remember when you were growing up, was politics discussed at home?
Constantly.
What kind of politics?
Left politics. My dad was, I'm never quite sure what my dad really was, but probably leaning towards being an anarchist.
But it was definitely a...
Very left-wing.
Yeah.
Revolution. The proletariat. The word proletariat, I learned that word real early in life. The working class was part of it.
When they moved to Seattle, do you remember what papers they read?
Both the Times and the Post Intelligence. I went to work for the Post Intelligence circulation.
You said they came in 30.
Yes. Right? Some of us came late in 29 and the rest of the time we moved in September 1930.
So the Union Record was no longer public?
No, it wasn't. But I delivered the Union Record at the youngster in Blaine, Washington.
Oh, yeah.
So I knew the paper, and I read it avidly.
How about your parents? Did they read it?
My dad. That was my dad's favorite paper, too.
Mm-hmm.
My mother didn't read very much.
Then you said you went to work for the PI?
Yeah.
I happen to, myself to know some of what you did there, but since the tape doesn't make you... Describe your job.
Well, I worked in circulation. I started out in 1930. That job was difficult to get, so I delivered papers to Blaine and Bellingham. So acquired a large paper out of Capitol Hill. Then I became assistant district manager, then district manager, and eventually promotion manager and area manager. It was all in circulation. I was there from 1930 until May 1954, except for the war years.
So all that time you were working in circulation?
Yes.
And since then, what are there other types of jobs you've had?
Well, it was difficult for me to find a job. I was cashier in 54 during the McCarthy period. So I went into the job that was always open, real estate. And I was in real estate from 55 until 62. And I went to work in the state of Washington, the state of Washington Department of Highway Exposure.
What's this organization that you belong to?
I belong to a member of the Communist Party.
Union?
Union, newspaper, yeah, and the state party.
Any fraternal or religious organization?
Oh, I remember that. No fraternal, no religious.
No other organization?
A Democratic Party. Washington Commonwealth Federation.
Right. When you remember the Democratic Party after you remember the Commonwealth Federation?
Probably about the same time.
Mm-hmm. Have you been, say you've been a politically active person?
All my life.
Uh-huh. And does that include voting?
Always voting, never missed an election.
Is that true from the time that you were first able to vote?
Yes.
What was the first election that you voted?
Roosevelt.
I think you were a little young for my service. Has there been a political leader in the last couple of years that you felt spoke for you, represented your point of view?
Well, because I'm not a member of the Communist Party anymore, but I'd say that Gus Hall, I agree with him almost identically agree with him.
What do you think is the most important issue facing the country today?
Peace.
What great people, either living or dead, do you admire most?
Marx. Lennon. Thomas Jefferson. Lincoln. President Wilson. Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt. Franklin D. Roosevelt. And I am Theodore Roosevelt, the elected queen. And of course, John is Bobby Kennedy.
Do you think that...
And the greatest man next to my father that I've ever known personally was Paul Robeson.
Do you think that most people can be trusted or that you can't be too careful to deal with people?
No, I'd like to trust people, but the pressures of life, even some decent people sometimes, the pressures of life, the pressure of maintaining a job. I found most people have a fragile point where they will give away secrets or give away confidence.
Do you think that most of the time people try to be helpful or they must be looking after themselves?
I'm ambivalent on that because before I became a recovered alcoholic, I thought people generally, except for left-wingers who were devoted to the cause and the struggle, that most people are pretty selfish. But now that I'm dealing mostly with senior citizens and their active schools, covered out college feelings. There's an awful lot of concern people. So the drive for the great disease of chasing hoarding gold does strange things to some people. But there's a large section of our society that are dedicated and to concern people.
Would most people try to take advantage of you if they got the chance, or if they try to be fair?
Well, I don't like to use the word most, but the fields I'm in now, increasing the number of people are helpful.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the civil rights movement?
Well, I was naturally very much for it, and still am, although the minority has a long way to go yet for the civil rights. The thing that, particularly in the black community, that I was really thrilled about, that increasingly number of blacks were taking over their leadership, whereas initially the civil rights movements were led by, more whites than blacks leading the civil rights movement. And in the recent years, the black people themselves have inserted themselves into the leadership. Naturally, I'm for all equal rights for all minorities, because the Indians, for instance, probably the most Hawaiians and Chicanos and others. And as a minority myself, I went through the prejudices of a small town. I know.
Say, as a minority, in what way is a minority?
Well, when we were the first Anglo-American family to move to Blaine, Washington, and Blaine, Washington, this was 1913, at that time it was a dying mill town, a single little lumber fish town, not a lot of unemployment for a small town, there was not a lot of poverty. We were probably the best fed children in town, mostly because we grew our own things by and large. But we were treated, well, I could make a comparison, we were treated like a black family moving into an all-white community like Bellevue. And I feel some of the scars, say that we had a family picnic yesterday, July 3rd, and we were discussing that, and some of us are still carrying. You don't have a tuba for on their shoulder, but we still have a toothpick. We were called dirty, greasy niggers and wops, and how many yards of spaghetti you have for breakfast, how many pounds of garlic people eat last week. To give an example, when I was in eighth grade, I was the smallest boy in the room, and I had to leave the senior play. And that was the first time in this poverty stricken town that I'd been asked out to a party. I was then 13 years old.
What about the student anti-war movement in the late 60s and early 70s? What did you think about that?
Well, I was very much afraid of it. I liked the freeway. I was really thrilled because it was the first time in the history of our country where the students gave leadership to a progressive cause. Was a primary force in this cause, because in all, most of the countries of the world, the students had left had led the great struggle. That wasn't the case in the United States until the Vietnam War. But I've been naturally thrilled. And I think to a large measure, not only does it help us out of the Vietnam War, but we had the state aid within that period because of the fascist nation. And you asked me earlier what the greatest threat was, well, of course, peace to me was primary because of the unthinkable of a war. But the danger of fascism in our country is much more real than most people realize still.
What do you think of the labor movement today?
I'm very unhappy with the labor movement because there are less than 20 million workers organized out of possible 90 million working class, working people in this particular class. I think it's social democratically led. I think it's just too many opportunists in the leadership. And of course, I think the greatest crime that in the Western world, all the unions have in their preamble, or at least in their constitution, struggle in the union is only a temporary thing. The goal was, of course, socialism, and of course, at least in their philosophy, that the union movement is just part of the struggle towards a socialist state. Mm. I think there's too many collaborators.
How about the women's movement?
Well, of course, I feel like just as strongly about equality as like the sexes I do in the relations. Of course, the sexes, the Equal Rights Amendment hasn't passed. But of course, on the other hand, too, I'm real thrilled at the advancements that women have made in my life and during my time because of the trade union strategy. There were 19 AFL unions that didn't allow blacks and other minorities in when I was a young man. A lot of unions at that time didn't allow women.
Do you think what most young people need most of all is strict discipline by their parents?
What most young people need is love. And I think there has to be a certain amount of discipline, but I don't believe in strict discipline.
Do you think most people who don't get ahead just don't have enough willpower?
No, it isn't that. It isn't what you consider going ahead. No, I don't think willpower, I think it's possible. It's just possible for all people to advance. Sometimes they're sick, sometimes the education isn't correct, the direction, their goals and this goal. They have poor parents, poor environments, and then constantly being unemployed, that's things. And I think we're developing our country now an indolent group by the constant unemployment.
Do you think a few strong leaders could make the country better than all the laws and the talking?
Well, we need, I don't know what that word strong would frighten me because I'm still so frightened of fascism. But leaders, we do need the country, we do need leaders like Roosevelt. But we also have to be a country of laws. That's one of the misnomers we have for people who fight socialism. We still don't have laws on socialism in regulated society.
Mm-hmm. People sometimes say an insult to your honor should not be forgotten. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. Because I think that's like carrying a grudge. It destroys you rather than. I have plenty of reasons to carry grudges, and I've lost them all. I think it was stupid. People who joined the FBI, I mean, they were communists and went to the FBI and said that I'd gotten them long ago and I hadn't carried a grudge.
How do you feel about the school
desegregation issue in the afternoon? Well, I think it's very sad because I don't think voluntary desegregation is going to work because there's too many hate, too much ignorance. I think it's going to have to be busted and torn.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to think that voluntary would work, but I don't think it will.
Mm-hmm. You mean like the magnet school?
Program? Yeah, right.
Do you think a general strike could occur today?
Impossible.
Impossible? Why do you say that?
Because the leadership is too weak and the many of the unions that are working, they live like middle-class Americans, upper-middle-class Americans. And the issues, there aren't enough issues to rally people around. It'd be impossible to call a general strike now and would fail at the end.
Under what conditions would you support a general strike?
Number one, that the Messiah could win. And then there were paramount issues and goals. You just don't strike for strike's sake, because any honest labor leader, strike is a weapon of last resort, and you want to make reasonably sure, as sure as you can be, that you're going to win.
Mm-hmm. How necessary are employers to running businesses? Workers run businesses without employers?
No, we don't need business. Yeah, you're right. Worker can be trained to run a business, trained to do anything. There isn't anything that the working class can't be trained to do.
How about cooperative businesses within a capitalist society to promote work?
Yes, yes. I think I'm for this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so what about the identity?
Well, at age 14, I forgot to mention earlier, but that was the first organization I joined. I joined the Industrial Workers of the World. I was greasing skids in the laundry camp. And of course,
laundry camps up north here.
Yeah, and I was a great admirer of the Industrial Workers.
What year was that?
1924, I was 14 years old.
So they had already started to do their work in...
They'd organized many years before that. In fact, they organized, they were part of the general strike in 1919. In fact, and it was called the Free Speech Fight on their own out in November 1916. So they were very active in the woods.
What did you think their role was in the 1919 fight?
Well, they were quite a few of them were. They not only were supporting, but they were in the leadership.
Who was the leadership? Who was
I don't recall the name.
So you're saying, what did you start to say about the Wobblers? It's just interesting stuff.
Shortly after the GI strike, the newspaper guild, I don't recall it that year, the next year, left the airport. No, they were already in the CIO, but they became rather a craft union. They became industrial union.
Was that under the urging of the communists in it? Or was that just a response to the times?
It was a response to the times, quite I knew, because I wasn't a member of the communist party at the time.
But you were a member of the guild already?
Yeah, I was a member of the guild. Well, as a matter of fact, Seattle, we call them circulation guilds. Classified guilds, business office guilds. We went industrial here, even organized the paper boys. We went industrial before the union officially did nationally. And then we became an industrial union, and shortly thereafter, we were organizing the circulation, and Dave Beck came in. And all the bosses, except the circulation manager, joined the Teamsters Union. So naturally, many of the workers joined along with them. And then some of a few of our own members joined the Teamsters. So when we petitioned them to negotiate, the jurisdiction dispute, and management refused to negotiate with us because it was all a jurisdictional dispute. So then we petitioned for an election with the National Labor Relations Board, and it dragged on a long time. And I met with representatives of the Teamsters Union, and we made an agreement on jurisdiction. We saw that better had part of the circulation. Otherwise, we might lose all of them. Then we had an election, and we won the bargaining rights for the remaining group.
Why did you think, you say you thought it would be better to have part of the circulation department and more from Holden? Why do people join the Teamsters? Is it because they deliver on bread and butter issues?
Well, we felt the time, to him. He said he joined the team in June because the boss was big. And they did sure their job.
You mean like the middle range department?
Yes.
Department?
Yes. So we, so then we finally made an agreement that, that all the members that, that delivered papers, whether the teacher dealer and the district manager and other people who managed to deal with that. And the main reason we made the agreement was because we've been 2 years attempting to negotiate. We thought it was best for the workers and also the people who were members of the teacher union, because we knew that we would negotiate first. And so we got a good contract. The teachers was also a good contract. And that's gone on during to this day. The guild negotiates the contract and then the teachers negotiate the actual paper.
So the teachers still now have like new toys and stuff like that delivery?
No, the teachers have anyone who delivers the paper in the car.
That's all.
Yeah, we tried to organize the new toys and failed.
So no one has new toys now?
Well, the carriers is called. The junior dealers, as they call them, nobody has them.
They're just like little kids mostly?
Yeah, right, yeah.
I guess there aren't too many in the city anymore because of those machines.
The we did organize the news vendors, and they finally gave up the jurisdiction to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now there's members of the FOCIO. But Dave Beck played a disruptive role. And that was the role that he played as boys.
No, just during the long strike of both?
Yes, and then one of the methods that Dave Beck used in organizing, too, is organize the bosses and then sign sweetheart contracts and enforce the workers. And the same thing they did with the fire workers in California.
Why is the thing, though, that at least in the East, the teams have a very good reputation for nothing except for that they do deliver on bread and butter issues? Is that after a while doing sweetheart contracts once you've been firmly, you put the screws on? But they do have a good reputation for cost of living stuff.
Yeah. Well, they signed the sweetheart contracts with the retail clerks and then they gave up the jurisdiction. They ran the features and now they're part of the retail clerks. But of course, the forces of time living in these times, force them to sign good contracts.
Mm-hmm.
They were organized sometimes for selfish reasons, but being in union eventually brought productivity to the use for the workers.
You think Beck, when I was talking to him, he's been a professional politician for a long time now, but he seems to me, naive as I am, to honestly believe that business unionism has improved the lot of the rank and file more than any other type of unionism could have. Do you think he honestly believes that?
Oh, I think he does. Because he's a social democrat. He thinks the capitalist system is working. You know, he's almost has to believe it's liberty. Are you still recording?
Yeah, it's still on, man. Yeah. You want me to turn it off?
Well, I don't care.
This is just because I think it'll be interesting for me to listen to.
Yeah, that's fine. Just leave it on. Well, I was elected to the community chest, as they call it, at the same time as Dave Beck. Also the newspaper guild, but he never attended. Then the Cadwell hearings started, so I just did.
What are those?
The Cadwell hearings was the Un-American Activities Committee for the state of Washington.
In 1940?
Yeah, in 1939 or 40. And they were directed primarily against the University of Washington. Professors and teachers, several teachers lost their jobs.
What? when around that time is when Western was
about the same time.
Were you
elected? I beg your pardon.
Were you part of the group that elected him? Was that the WCF?
The Washington Commonwealth Federation. I was part of it, but I didn't play a too active a role in his election because he was in Sonoma County and I worked in Seattle too.
How come there wasn't any sort of as he explained to me, we just talked a little bit about it. He didn't seem to say that there was any big organizing going on around that fight. You know, once they decided to throw him out, because they just took it to the court. But there doesn't seem to have been any sort of demonstrations.
Well, I thought the titles were doing enough to fight it, but it was almost an impossible situation. The only place that was fought was in the court. And then it was kind of hard to rally people around because of the Red Day. At that time, there was great uncertainty in this country whether we were going to fight for Hitler or fight against Hitler.
Mm-hmm. It does seem unusual, though, that for Washington, which has been such a progressive state, around 1940 really wasn't, in most of the country, a time of very high Red Scare.
One of the reasons is because the Washington Commonwealth Federation, which was a political organization of workers, you would probably call the Independent Guys Party, we elected so many of our members to the legislature. That was about the time that Farley said the United States had 47 states and the Soviet of Washington. And I imagine the FBI was, well, in fact, I don't imagine, I'm certain the FBI was involved in it and decided to do something about it. Because this was the most progressive state in the country, and it was one to be picked off. And there was great liberal activity on the campus. The legislature, we just had some fine people there.
Was there any significant number, were members of the party elected at that time?
Not by the party members.
Oh, there were people who went on leave the way Venus did?
Yes.
And got elected?
Yes.
Were there some the same year that Venus got elected and got barred?
No. Venus was the only one who was barred.
Who were there others that year who were elected that they didn't know about?
Sit
in the legislature that year?
Several.
That's funny. Yeah. You know what happened when much earlier this year, when I had just gotten up to Seattle, I was sitting around at a union retiree meeting. I went to a lot of those to try to find people who didn't hear the strike.
Yeah.
And one guy sitting around just started bragging about this incident in 1940 where he had been in the state legislature. And one of these goddamn commies who tried to get elected as a Democrat, and he'd been on that committee that did the minority report and everything. And I just sort of let it go by. I mean, you know, I didn't think about it until I was interviewing Linus, and I had no idea that Linus was the person who it had happened to, you know? And he started describing it from the other side.
Yeah, there was logical, from the right, logical reason to pick on the state of Washington. It was such a great state, really. Mm-hmm. The plain dealer with Washington, the Washington Commonwealth Federation was a strong organization. And I've always felt that the party made a mistake when they terminated it.
Is that how it died out?
They wouldn't have dissolved it.
Yeah. Why did that happen?
Because that was about the time the party changed itself to the Communist Political Organization. And it was a mistake made. I figured it was a fellow's mistake. I thought it was a mistake to quit the Washington plain dealer and to dissolve the Washington Commonwealth Federation.
I don't understand why they tried to do that. What year was that?
I don't remember.
Around when? After the war?
After the war. The late, the early 50s, in the 50s.
So sort of at the height of the hysteria?
Yeah.
So I don't understand. As well as dissolving the party in Maine, they also
later on dissolved the Washington Federation.
I don't understand what the reasoning was for that.
I don't even understand to this day.
You don't remember the reasons given?
No, I don't recall. No. I think it was the work within the Democratic Party. Carlson. a lot of the issues of old age pensions and things were. I always felt it was wrong when they dissolved the old age pension union.
I heard that was very successful for a while.
Yes, but I think they should have changed it because even though they getting Social Security, the problem was still here for the senior citizens.
Yeah. Were those two organizations already seen pretty clearly around as Communist Front organizations?
Oh, pretty well. They were generally described.
So were they no longer effective? Or were they still being, were they still pretty effective?
Well, I thought they were effective.
Hmm. What kind of, it's something I've never really discussed with my father, what kind of different left parties that I've had experiences have different degrees of democratic centralism? That is, some of them fall more heavy on centralism part, some of them fall more heavy on the democratic part. What was, in your experience, CC, how much of each of those was there? Was it, I mean, there have been some criticisms against the party that it was pretty much a top-down thing, that the rank and file didn't have too much say in determining policies. Was that
true of the
of the party here?
Well, I never felt that way. No, I never felt that way.
There was a lot of democratic policy making?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah. I felt that way. I never felt uncomfortable.
Well, something like, say, a decision as big as, maybe there was no choice, but a decision as big as whether the USCP was gonna endorse the Stalin Hitler Pact. Was that ever discussed at a grassroots level, or was that just came down
oh, yeah.
the line?
That oh,
was
yeah. Oh,
discussed?
Oh, yeah.
After the decision was made by the Soviet Union?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Ah. And a majority of the party just
that it was important to back the Soviet Union. Right. Oh, yeah, that was disgusting. You're a very interesting person. I wish you well.
Well, how do you say that?
Oh, you are. You're bright.
You're an interesting person to say. That's why I've got my tape recorder on.
That's your choice. But you understand the Dave Beck role, the man. I mean, did that explain to you before how he organized the Boeing behind the word?
No, Boeing, I never heard of his role. Yeah,
yeah, well, he did the same thing at Boeing. He organized the workers behind the, after the strike.
This is the long, like, 6-month strike?
Yeah, right.
Boeing?
He organized the union and got a lot of members there. Yeah, the workers are frightened. Some join.
Did they lose that strike?
Oh, yes.
So they lost and they were vulnerable and then they started raiding?
Yeah, and the unions never survived. Never survived that strike. It's still a very non-militant, social democratic, opportunistically led. Was it ever played through the role of Dave Beck taking organizing associations and freezing out small businesses?
No. Oh, I have heard traces of the
Washington Well, give an example. Give me a good example. A friend of mine owned Whistle Pop. He and his dad owned it, first and second generation Italian. So it was a very popular pop at that time, almost as popular as Coca-Cola is now. But Dave Beck organized the Beverage Association. And this Italian, his name was Mazzoni, asked him to join the association. He said, no, I'm in America. I don't have to belong to anything. I don't want to belong to. And so his son was beaten up, and the truck's dumped. And so eventually they were out of business. And of course, Glacier, as I recall, was one of the big names. A lot of little people were frozen out, and the big ones took over. They did the same thing with the milk.
I've heard this. Beck, the reason Beck did that, if I understand, was to keep up prices, to keep up wages, was that?
Well, he did mostly to create a monopoly. He did the same thing with beer. He tried to keep Eastern beer out because he had a pact with Emil Sink of the Rainier Brewery.
But from Labor's point of view, he was claiming that those sort of associations would pay higher wages because they were making more money by fleecing the consumer, sort of?
Well, that was never
thought. I mean, yeah, but was that his thinking on it?
I don't know what he's thinking about, but I think his thinking was to create a monopoly. And, of course, he'd organize the workers underneath. He did the same thing with milk. He did the same thing with the cleaning establishment. There was a time that you, it was a central place where you had to send all your clothes. You couldn't even clean the clothes yourself. All you did was press them. So, he formed all kinds of associations.
He gave me a book to read called The Coming of Peace, The Power in the West. It's a book written about him with his help from academic down
there. The thing is that I'm not going to impugn his feelings. There's no question. I mean, we've discussed, I discussed on the phone last night with a friend. The workers are better off in Seattle because Dave Beck lived. Well, there's no question that they are. And in these elite unions, like 174 and the regular truck drivers, they have wonderful wages and conditions and a terrific pension.
Mm-hmm.
But some of these things he had to do in spite of his philosophy.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, when I asked him what he thought of the labor movement today, when I asked him that same question, he said his biggest complaint about it, and again, I think he was leveling with me, though I really didn't know where to tell him, was that it's not militant enough. It's like, this is something I'd really like to get at. I think it's only in the United States to have this line between being left-wing and being militant. And in most countries, like in Europe, those two things go together. The most militant trade union is socialist. But here...
Well, Dave Beck would mean militant this way, without political action. In other words, supporting comfortable causes. See, that would be milk. Wages, hours, you know, it's like an IW. In the first place, his philosophy would be that the wages, hours, and working conditions. And politically, you just support those soft things, you know, the main big issues. Like the problem of the Middle East and things like that. You take a pro-capitalist point of view, and then that'd be, well, to give you an example, like the gasoline tax. See, you'd be melting before it, because the most conservative unions in the state, the building trades, think they're going to benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what is militancy. See, it's a limited militancy, as long as you don't take too strong a political action.
Yeah.
In other words, as long as your political action isn't left, he'll go support strikes and things for wages and hours and wages.
But he will draw the line on strikes when he thinks it's going to threaten the existence of a business.
Yeah, oh yes, oh definitely. There'd be no strikes.
Yeah.
See, because my philosophy is if a business can't pay a living wage, they have no business to be in business.
Yeah. Something I was just going to ask you about. Yeah. Oh no, it was something different. I don't know if you can answer this because you're maybe too young at the time, but one of the things I'm trying to write on is some people like Charlie Doyle. Remember Charlie Doyle?
Yes.
He claimed in an interview in about 1940 that the general strike in 1919 had thrown the labor movement in Seattle back 15 years. Do you remember when you first started working, since that was, say it was 24 when you started working?
Yeah.
Do you remember, were people still talking about the...
Oh, yeah.
Strike? What were they saying about it?
Well,
did working people remember it with pride or with horror?
Or in 24 they did.
They remembered it with pride?
Yeah, not a lot.
Not just the left wing, but just
others.
Right? Well, really?
But I think it did hurt the labor movement.
In what way? Because it was lost?
Because it was lost.
Did people clearly see it as being lost?
Yeah, most people did, especially people who worked in labor.
Did they think Goldie Hanson had cracked it?
Oh, there's no question.
Did people, at least, did working people know the role of international officers in going through the strike, or was that not a...
Oh, that was well known. Just to broke the strike.
It was well known that the union was broken?
Yeah, right, the international. Washington.
Yeah, I'll bet. Yeah. The Wobbles are still a force in Seattle in
24?
Oh, boy. I don't know, a lot of teams are still being...
Well, I wasn't in Seattle, don't forget. I was in Washington County.
Oh, so you up north where they were stronger.
Yeah, right. They weren't very strong in Seattle.
Yeah.
Well, Craig, look how long, I can tell you how the good effects of the fact, look how long the Union record lasted. The Union record lasted until, in my memory, from 26, isn't it?
28
maybe.
Yeah. So do you think there was a good effect of strike?
Yeah, it's
circulation.
Yeah.
You know, right after strike went past everything else.
Yeah, right. Oh yeah, it had a good effect. It was great pride. Of course, you have to remember too that the lower middle class, and then the struggle for existence is so difficult that the workers, a lot of them don't understand. You know. But there was real enthusiasm.
Did the union record circulation, well, I'd like to know where I could find some records on their circulation. Did their circulation stay up at that, what I've read is that right after the strike, they went up to 100,000, the
Texas
Star, which I guess was the leading paper then in circulation at the time, which it was. Did it stay there for any length of time?
No. To my knowledge, no.
Records of that in circulation. I went to their paper to head over to you. They had their paper.
Geez, I haven't any idea. They talk about name Joe Corbett. Last one, but that he was in the editorial. I don't think he's on it. But that is pretty senile, too.
Oh, yeah. Carl Potts, I called, you know?
Yeah.
He didn't want to talk, though. I don't remember if that was because he wasn't in at the time of the strike, or just because he didn't want to talk to me. Well, a couple of people said, I just don't want to talk about this time, you know?
Yeah, well, they're afraid, too, to see that the South become rich, he's a millionaire.
It really?
Well, at least he's pretty rich.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Because, you know, I read a long series of letters and telegrams from him to all when Haas was going around, sort of the only correspondent, you know, he was the roaming correspondent, the rest of Washington. Every letter starts with him saying, you got to send me my wages, I got no money, you know?
Yeah.
You got to send me some money.
Yeah. Carl Haas, I'm pretty sure I know he's comfortable with it, but he's a millionaire about his company. See, and then as you get richer, you erode your system. Then, of course, you get older. You get tired. You know, most people they get tired of struggles. But I think really Sal Haas just eroded.
Yeah.
That's why he didn't want to talk about it. See, it's just like people that fought with Abraham Lincoln Brigade in Spain. A lot of them don't want to talk about it. Well, they're comfortable now, they're middle class people, and they're cool place to work.
Is that what happened to Ralph Chaplin?
I imagine.
How did he go? He really became right wing, didn't he?
Yeah, right.
Was he from around here also?
Yes. My best friend was on. Have you ever met any of them? Have you ever met any of the gay people?
I don't think I have. Although, I mean, I'm sure I did when I was young. I'm sure they were.
Yeah, we had a few of them. 40th.
Were you in that?
What, the 40th anniversary?
No, were you in the area?
No, I didn't, because people around me felt I wouldn't call them, but still had to be important responsibility.
Yeah. So you said it was a 40th anniversary?
Yeah, I went to the 40th anniversary to see the congregational church and one of the churches there.
What was that like? That must have been weird.
No, where we headed is at the, what do you call it? I've been to so many churches with farm workers and others. That's the only time I've been inside the church. But anyway, Unitarian Church, Church, real liberal.
Yeah, right.
Christ, we had 100-some people there.
Really?
We had the national commander there, and he was from Canada. They, I don't know, I've forgotten what they call it, Canada or something else. We had people from all around.
So what would you say is the social standing amongst those people now? What are their politics and what are their lifestyles and everything?
Well,
they're mostly middle-class liberals now?
Well, well, some of them are still working class and then, you know, middle-class liberals.
Mm-hmm.
Lower middle class, once they were there.
Huh.
But then, you know, when you get struggle for existence, and when you get money, you erode, in many cases, your principles.
Yeah. When I was first became sort of a Miller socialist in college, you know, the late 60s, and one of the things I did was I just hated liberals. I very infrequently saw my parents. Once I went to visit my father in New York, and I said to him, you know, how could all you guys who are commies in the 30s be liberals now, you know? I just, how could that be? And he said, he explained to me real well, he said, look, when I was growing up, you know, I grew up poor in this fashion, when I was growing up, maybe there was someone in the real extended family who had any money at all, and if you wanted anything like a pair of shoes to go to school with, anything like that, you could go on your hands and knees and beg that person for just stuff that you needed to exist. He said, at that time I decided no one should be poor, and that's why I became a communist, but I also decided if anyone was going to be poor from now on, it wasn't going to be me anymore, and that's why I became a liberal.
What do you do for yourself?
Well, After college, I worked and did mostly factory work for a couple of years, saved a little money from that, and then now, if they think that you're promising material in graduate school, they give you what are called teaching assistantships, where, you know how those work?
Yes.
Really, it's funny, because here we are, I've been trying to organize the graduate students a lot, because it's amazing the degree of control that they only give you about $3,000 a year, right? But you can live on it. The hours are great, you know. You work, but universities that sometimes stand live off of their graduate students. That's how they survive. Because what they do is they'll have these big classes, you know, maybe between 200 and 600 people. Professor will lecture two or three times a week, but people can't learn from that. So they have these discussion groups. Maybe you'll have between one and five teaching assistants, and we run the discussion groups. And without those discussion groups, where there may be 20 people or 15 people in the discussion group, most students, I don't think, could assimilate what it is that's being lectured, because they never get a chance to ask anything, you know, these gigantic lecture halls. So that's how, so I do that, and I get sometimes I'll do some work during the summer, just physical work, and sometimes I get a little money from outside consulting work, you know, designing.
What's your aim, Pete?
Yeah, my aim is really, you know, try to have a socialist revolution in the country, so I can't see going through graduate school for another couple of years.
You're not going to get your PhD.
Sometimes I think, yeah, I should. In a way, it's insurance, you know.
I think so.
It's hard. I guess I would like to alternate between doing factory work, organizing factories, and...
Excuse me, sir. Well,